This is 16.9 The Podcast. I'm Dave Haynes. 16.9 has been online now for more than a decade, looking at the digital signage business and filtering the BS. Now it's also a podcast, a chance to talk to smart people doing interesting things in this business. You can listen to episodes online, grab it from iTunes or Google Play, or use your favorite podcast app to grab the RSS feed. 16.9 is sponsored and supported by ScreenFeed, the digital signage content store. In this episode, I'm speaking with Jeff Hastings, the CEO of BrightSign, which designs, builds and markets little purple boxes used by a lot of network operators as media players. How good is business? He's shipping about 1,000 units a day out of his Silicon Valley facilities. Hastings talks about BrightSign's direct ties to another purple box company, Roku, and about how that evolved. He also talks about where the company and industry is headed. We did this by Skype, so it gets a little scratchy here and there. So Jeff Hastings, thanks for doing this.
Thanks, Dave. How you doing?
I'm good. I know BrightSign pretty well, but for people who don't know much about BrightSign, can you give me a rundown on the company, how you got started, and kind of where it's at right now?
Yeah, so BrightSign was originally part of Roku. I think most people, at least in the U.S., know about Roku. They're a little streaming device for watching over-the-top television. And Roku was originally started with a concept of basically bringing internet content into the home. And as the business grew up, it grew up into two businesses, a commercial business and a consumer business. So in 2009, Anthony Wood and I got together and we actually split Roku into two companies, a commercial company and a consumer company. We rebranded the commercial company BrightSign, and that was the birth of BrightSign. And I'm on the board of Roku and Anthony is on the board of BrightSign. So we're still, you know, we still talk to each other and things like that. But, you know, from companies, we're two totally different companies. We have our own engineering staff. So that's kind of how we got started. And basically, you know, our whole kind of calling is really very similar to what Roku does for the consumer world. We do for the commercial world is basically building a dedicated appliance that is really purpose-built to create a, you know, a really a digital experience outside the home with video monitors. So, you know, this can be anything from very simple POP displays like the GoPro displays. You see all those around, those have bright signs in them, which is very super simple but very effective in terms of showing video. And then all the way out to things that where they're creating museum experiences with interactivity and all kinds of video walls all being displayed together. So all those things are things that we do as a dedicated appliance versus using a PC and having to kind of fight a device that really is not intended to be kind of left alone and run 24 hours a day.
So the commercial business for Roku, what was that? Like, how did it end up getting into a commercial side of that business?
So the original product that Roku built was, you know, basically a little media device that could take video and images from either memory cards or, you know, little flash memory cards or over the internet, kind of digital art. And what happened was Bose was one of the first people to get the idea that they wanted a more educated salesperson at the retail locations to talk about their product. And they looked into, you know, could we actually hire enough people to be in all these retail locations? And they realized that that was just not very feasible. And so their advanced technology group came up with the idea that, hey, if we could build this device in the store that could educate and show off our technology, then we'd have something that was very scalable and cost effective. And they actually prototyped that with the very first Roku device. Mm. And that was really the birth of kind of the commercial business. And as they started using it and started scaling it up, it created a, you know, basically a little nascent business inside Roku that was focused on commercial side.
Okay. So when Anthony came to you and said, you know, I think we should break this off into its own entity, were you excited or terrified?
Well, when I first looked at it, I'm like, oh, let me see, Anthony. This is the part of the company that no one wants to invest in, and they want to invest in the consumer side. So I was like, oh, I don't know. This business is losing money and no one wants to invest in it. But I took a few months and actually looked into the market and thought, you know what? I think there really is a market, and it really is going to be a transformation of moving from kind of heavyweight PCs into a very lightweight purpose-built device. And, you know, looking at the broader market was, how do we make it easy for folks, you know, the system integrators, to be able to deploy this. And that's really took the original idea and built it into a product that was going to be easy for the end user to have it up and running and keep going over a long periods of time without having to worry about software updates or security updates or trying to boot the PC into a mode where it doesn't have a mouse and keyboard, things like that. So we really took that kind of mindset and mantra and said, hey, this thing has to be able to update itself, has to be able to recover over the internet without anyone ever touching it. And that's really where we drove from kind of the original move away from the PC approach.
Mm-hmm. Are Roku and BrightSign co-located, like same building, same zip code, anything, or are they really separate entities?
Well, you know, it's a bit funny. We were when we originally split them off because the employees were all based in the same location. We then moved. They were in Saratoga, and we moved to Los Gatos because one of the things you realize as you run a company is whenever you try to move the location of the company, there's always going to be winners and losers. So the farther you move the company, the more angst that you have. So when we moved one exit down the highway to a town called Los Gatos, California, which is, you know, I don't know what, 2-3 miles from where Roku was. And most of the employees, it really didn't change their commute because commute is a big deal in Silicon Valley. So we moved the company and we were away from them. And then just recently, they moved into the old Netflix building, and the old Netflix building is about 3 blocks from our building. So now we're actually physically close again, not out of any conscious moves, but just happened to be where the real estate was available.
Hmm. And how many people do you have working with you?
At BrightSign, we're just under 80 people here.
Mm-hmm. And how much of that is engineering?
About half of it is engineering. Okay. We have 3 engineering locations here, of course, in Los Gatos, California. We have a Cambridge, UK development group and also an Odessa, Ukraine development group. And each group kind of focuses on their own core competencies, but it allows us to really have, you know, folks around the world continually developing our effort and focusing on the things that they're best at.
So how did you end up with the Odessa office?
Well, a little bit of a long story, but we originally were contracting with them. It was a group that was a contracting firm in the Ukraine doing web development. And then the owner of the company decided that he didn't really want to run the company anymore, and we'd become a significant part of their business. Mm. So I approached him and said, hey, we really like your group. And so we just end up essentially buying his company. Then all the engineers were based in Odessa. So we just kept them there. We've continued to grow that group, and we've actually taken them from not only doing development, but doing a lot of support. So we do a lot of our first tier support out of the Ukraine now.
Hmm. Okay. And understanding that they're separate companies, is there much shared DNA in the 2016 version of the products now between like a Roku box and a BrightSign box?
At the core of them, you know, it's the same DNA. I mean, it's literally, you know, they were the same product. But what's happened is, you know, the Roku guys have really, you know, moved down the path to have the lowest price hardware that you can possibly build and really focused on pure streaming technologies because that's their market. Mm-hmm. And our market is more about higher end experiences. So we're less focused on kind of making the hardware, you know, be free, but more making the hardware much more cost competitive against a PC platform and the reliability. So it's kind of gone in different directions from the original development. But a funny thing about it is if you go to write a Roku channel, it's actually written in BrightScript, and it's the same BrightScript that you use in the BrightSign. So there's a lot of core DNA that's still there from the very beginning.
But it would be a pretty wild misrepresentation for somebody to say a BrightSign box is a Roku box with a metal enclosure and maybe a couple of different connectors.
Yeah. And, you know, probably in the early days, you might have gotten away from that. But now the hardware is completely diverged.
Yeah. So one of the numbers that really intrigues me is 800,000, which is the number I see in terms of the size of your installed base out there. Like, that's a big number.
It's a big number, and, you know, probably late this year, sometime early next year, we're going to cross over 1 million devices deployed. You know, most people don't think of kind of those types of numbers, and I routinely see a lot of software companies talking about the number of devices they have deployed, and I realize, like, wow, we've got 1 million devices, which is a lot. But it's something that we've been driving hard on. I mean, basically our whole philosophy is to be the platform that you can deploy any software on, not only our software, but other CMS platforms. And that really helps us drive volume. You know, the key thing about hardware is you need to have volume. If you don't have volume, it's just a subscale type business. And then you're usually sourcing the product. One thing that we do that's pretty much different from anyone else in this industry is that we literally design the circuit boards and the circuitry, everything from the ground up. We have a contract manufactured in China through a partnership of a contract manufacturer I've worked with for almost 20 years now. But the actual design is all our design and all our intellectual property. And by doing that, it gives us the ability to put special features and things into it that's, you know, that's very significant and brings down the cost. And by driving down the cost, we're able to get the volume. And when you have enough volume, you get access to the latest semiconductor technology, which, you know, continues to improve the performance of the box.
So the PC side of the digital signage business has been, I don't know if I'd say hurt, but it's certainly been challenged by the arrival of all these set-top boxes from Shenzhen running Android and Chrome bits and PCs on sticks and everything else. Have you felt that as well, or have you been somewhat immune to that?
You know, for the most part, we've been immune from it. We've seen those come out. A lot of the Android devices, the great thing that they have is a low price. The bad thing that they have is reliability. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why we actually don't run Android as a native operating system. The chips that we have supports it, but we don't run it. And a lot of it's because Android, in an ironic way, is very similar to a Microsoft operating system. It was built and intended for end user contact, and it wants interaction. That's what it's built for. The Mac OS is built that way. Windows OS built for that. Even the Chrome OS that, you know, is kind of Google's latest offering is all built around the concept that it wants interactivity and that, yeah, you can do some kind of kludges to put it in a weird mode. But at the core of it, when you bring it out of the box, it wants someone to play with it. Ours is exactly the opposite. Ours basically is built on the expectation that there's going to be no user interaction with setting it up and that it all should be able to be handled, you know, remotely and including all updates and things like that. So, you know, when we look at kind of the low-end devices that come out of Shenzhen, most people have been disappointed when they've done deployments with them. And, you know, it's one thing when you do a deployment of 5 or 10 devices, it kind of doesn't matter the reliability because there's enough people around to support it. But when you start rolling out thousands of units to, you know, a geographically dispersed area, reliability becomes a significant point, not only because you don't have the ability to kind of monitor them, but also the ability to fix them. So, you know, if I do a big retail deployment, you know, at all the Best Buys, let's say I want to put in a retail display. So, you know, it's roughly 1,000 stores. I put 1,000 stores out there and, you know, it's going to cost me probably about $1,000 per display to get it installed. If something goes wrong with that display, it's going to cost me about $200 to get someone in there and get that fixed. So if you take, you know, let's just take one of the low-cost Android players and you paid $100 for it, you could have bought a BrightSign for $250 and basically had something that's reliable, and now you don't have to worry about it going down or, you know, worried about someone going out and fixing it. So what most people have learned that reliability is far more important than originally thought because the cost to repair these things in the field is very high.
Mm-hmm. Is your buying audience primarily systems integrators and guys who understand that whole experience of trying to use cheap crap and they understand I'm putting 500 of these out, they need to just last and last and last? Or are you selling to entry-level people who are really new to the space?
We sell to pretty much everyone. Okay. Everything from our web store to, you know, people buying thousands of units. We kind of sell to them all. And even for the people that are doing small amounts of these, they're realizing that the power, the reliability, the stability of it even pays off at the low end. So we get, you know, we get tons of orders every day on our website for 1, 2, 4 units. And those people are literally self-servicing themselves. And most of them, we you know, we've done nothing to really market to them in terms of like, you know, Google AdWords and things like that. It's a lot of word of mouth for the small ones. A lot of museums and places like that buy tons of our devices, kind of onesie twosies, and they're deployed, you know, in all these little locations all over the world.
Hmm. Does online represent much of your overall sales? Because I know other other attempts at selling online just doesn't work.
Yeah, so you know, for us, it's a few percent of our business. But it's a very interesting part of our business because it gives us a lot of exposure to just kind of the masses trying to do different projects. So, you know, what typically ends up happening is a lot of people buy them online and they've either had experience with them before, so they're fine with them, or they buy it, like they then contact us and like, hey, we're trying to do something bigger. We've developed some prototypes with your product and it works well. Do you have some folks that can help us scale? And we have a lot of partners who can help them scale from, you know, a prototype to doing large deployments.
Mm-hmm. Is much of your sales therefore direct, or do you rely pretty heavily on partners?
Pretty much everything we do, with very few exceptions, is through the channel.
Okay. So your sales guys are developing and maintaining or managing your channels.
Exactly. And although we will go and present to a lot of end customers to present our technology and talk about the reliability and the goodness of it, the reality is we then hand those deals over to integrators and other folks in our channel to actually take the deal.
Which is why something like Infocom and ISC over in Amsterdam are big, big shows for you.
Absolutely. You know, between Infocom and ISC, those are our two most important shows of the year.
Okay. There's a bunch of costs involved in putting this podcast together, so I'm very grateful for the support this podcast will get from our new and sole sponsor, ScreenFeed. Here's founder and CEO, Jeremy Gavin.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Gavin, CEO of ScreenFeed, the digital signage content store. As content people, we love great content, and we think Dave's doing a great job with this 16.9 podcast, which is why we've offered to sponsor it. If you'd like to see the content that we create on a daily basis, head over to screenfeed.com and check it out. Let us know if we can help you in any project you're working on. And do me a favor, if you don't find what you're looking for, shoot me an email at jeremy@screenfeed.com. I'm always interested in new ways we can help. Now back to the podcast.
And the Brightside boxes, they don't have an operating system. Like, they're not running Windows or Linux or Android or anything else, are they? They're kind of running their own scripts?
In general, yes. But at the core of it is our own derivative Linux that we've developed. So the core operating system we developed on is Linux, but it's not exposed anywhere. It's you know, I always kid people that, you know, if you go in and look at your kitchen, there's all these things running in your kitchen. There's a refrigerator, there's the oven and the toaster. Ironically, every one of those has some kind of operating system in it, but you would never know that. And it's the same with our device. It's meant to do its purpose in life and not really expose the operating system. Because the reality is there's very few people in the world that's kind of qualified to, especially in this kind of digital signage channel, that can be writing applications based on Linux or even Android applications with good reliability, because most of the vendors are subscale. So for us, we built a box that allows you to configure it and use all the tools that we've built without actually knowing what operating system is underneath.
So if I'm somebody who's already using some content management system out there, one of the hundreds of them, and I want to stick with that, I still want that to be my user experience, how easy or hard is it for a BrightSign box to be kind of layered into that network?
Well, you know, it really depends on the architecture of the content management system. But you know, every year we probably add 5 to 10 different CMS vendors that basically are compatible with our system. And for most of them, the back ends are built to be network-based anyway, because they're, you know, that's the way these devices are deployed. So what we do is what we call a network integration. Instead of trying to say, oh, you've got some player software that's running on the Mac or on Windows or on Linux, we basically take our toolkit on our player, which is a great toolkit for doing pretty much anything you want in the digital signage area, and writing, as I mentioned earlier, in the little Bright script or JavaScript to basically take their network payloads from their CMS and then display them in the way they want them to do. And we've done that many, many times, and it's pretty simple since we have a large toolkit kind of sitting baked into our player.
Okay, so this is not a 6-month job for a CMS company to do this.
No, most of the times we work with these companies, it's 2 to 3 months and it's completely done and they're deploying it. And in fact, some of them, it's literally a couple of weeks. A lot of the CMS systems have been pushing out HTML 5 and our players easily consume that. So literally they can take our off the shelf tools and configure it and have in less than a week have it up and running.
And you've been kind of pushing the envelope, so to speak, on some of the newer technologies out there like HTML5 and like H.265. Has that resulted in companies coming your way because they're attracted by those capabilities?
Yeah, so there's, you know, a few big things that's kind of happening in the technology space. You know, first is, you know, content development and building these user experiences is always hard. I mean, it's just, you know, content by its kind of very nature is very custom. And so with HTML5, there's a large group of people that's been doing websites and things like that that have a lot of the interactive kind of capabilities or different screen layouts and display of information. So basing kind of your display language on HTML allows you to not really do anything magical, but it allows you to tap into a much larger base of content developers that know how to do this. If you look kind of historically, you know, people had built digital signage systems with kind of user interfaces where they were trying to build content development tools. And the reality is there's really only one company that does a really good job in building content development tools, and that's Adobe. And they kind of own that marketplace. And what we looked at was HTML5 was the place where kind of the Adobe world overlaps into the digital signage world so that you have an incredibly large base of people who can develop content. And that's really why we pushed into the world with HTML5 and was one of the first people to start really being a proponent of that. The second part is on video compression. H.265 is going to be the new compression format. And if you go back historically, you know, I could point out kind of every major video compression when it came out, everyone said, oh my God, that's too complex and no one will adopt it. And, you know, over time they adopted it, whether it was MPEG-2, whether it was H.264 and now H.265. We see it as a really big breakthrough. One, it makes 4K content manageable over today's networks. And then secondly, for kind of 1080p content, it reduces the bandwidth by about 60% over H.264. And it allows you to start doing things that before would be never considered. Whereas in today's world, if you wanted to be distributing a lot of content, you could have kind of, you know, think of it as kind of channels running around in your corporate network, 10 or 20 channels of H.265 1080p streaming content that anyone can kind of switch to, much like a broadcast television station. Before, that was unthinkable when you were either doing MPEG-2 or even H.264. But in the world of H.265, you can put that stuff on the network. It really has no real draw in terms of network bandwidth, yet gives you the flexibility to distribute this video anywhere in the enterprise.
So for people who are listening to this and don't quite totally get what you're talking about, what you're effectively saying is bandwidth or the size of the files drop in half, so therefore it doesn't flood your network and you're not at risk of not being able to transact or process credit card transactions or things like that.
Exactly. I mean, it basically just makes it so that it's such a small amount of data that's going over your network that it doesn't have an impact on it. Yep.
So what would be the largest deployment of BrightSign boxes out there, you know, like in one place or over one network that you can talk about?
I'm trying to think of ones that we can talk about. We've recently done a lot of, you know, deployments in kind of Best Buy with large CE customers. GoPro, I talked about them. I mean, they're probably one of the biggest ones. And, you know, they have well over 50,000 devices that been deployed. Another one, kind of another, you know, that was a manufacturer, but Verizon through their cellular sales found over 1,000 devices, maybe 2,000 devices in there. But, you know, our large networks go from the very large ones are in the, you know, 50 to 150,000 devices. And the what I'd say is kind of the, you know, the routine ones that we now do kind of routinely large are in the 2,000 to 4,000 devices.
So that's really interesting because I would say for the most part in the digital signage industry, when a sales guy comes back to the office and with a closed deal for 1,000 software licenses and players, like everybody in the office is doing cartwheels.
Yeah, so I think that's what's a little bit different about us. I mean, we'll ship this year around 200,000 devices.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you work that out, you've got to have a lot of 1,000 unit deals. I mean, well, yeah, if you work out the math, it means pretty much every business day there's 1,000 units going out the door.
Yeah, that's not happening in a lot of offices.
I know, in
the designer space.
But that's what we've built. And we've built a business that is really scalable. And, you know, a lot of people get confused about BrightSign thinking that, oh, well, you guys players only run your software. And it's not. You know, basically, we built a software platform and you can use as much or as little as our software platform with, you know, either to deploy a solution with all our software, or we're more than happy to hook it into other CMS systems. Because at the end of the day, our business really is, as I tell most people, we sell purple boxes. That's our business. And everything we do around that is to sell more purple boxes.
Are there any constraints in terms of using a BrightSign box versus using a Windows-based PC? Are there reasons, is there at some point where you say, our box doesn't do that?
In terms of kind of raw capabilities, no. What does happen is, you know, our box is not going to run Excel. So if you want to run Excel, you're not going to be able to do that. But then again, we don't want our boxes running Excel. So if you're trying to run an existing application, which would be rather odd, there are some existing applications that are just not going to run because it's not supported what we do. But any kind of media handling, presentations, all those interactivity, all those things are kind of built in. And if you're going to do it, we're going to give you a far better experience than a PC, especially when you look at the cost of ownership and reliability.
So, yeah, I mean, you can drive an interactive experience. You can drive a big-ass video wall, whatever it needs to be in the context of digital signage.
Exactly. And the other thing that we do is we do this at dramatically lower power than what a PC does. So if you look at a PC that you want to do 4K video, which is, you know, rapidly becoming kind of the standard where people are putting out new digital signs because the displays are all moving to 4K, you know, you're going to need a PC that's going to be running, you know, at 80 watts of power. Our 4K player runs at 15 watts of power. So it literally allows you to do things where you can actually run it with PoE. So you can run it power over Ethernet versus having to have an AC plug. And it's those kind of things when you start doing large deployments. You know, we've done a lot of stadiums. And in stadiums, you know, you can easily pack 3,000 devices into a stadium. And if you have plugs in all those places and power supplies that are all not consolidated, it means maintenance is a lot harder. Whereas with PoE, you know, the networking guys have known that for a long time, that you can consolidate the power supplies, you can have redundant power supplies, and you run that power down the Ethernet cables, it's a far more sustainable solution. And so that's what we do. You know, our high-end players allow you to do all this over PoE.
Yeah, and just consider the capital cost of all that electrical infrastructure that you don't have to put in with all the conduit and everything.
Yeah, I mean, the ongoing cost. I mean, you know, electricity is not free. And literally, a PC easily can consume 5 to 8 times more power than a BrightSign doing the same thing.
Right. So where do you see things going, both for your company and the signage industry in general? I realize the part two of that question is a pretty broad question, but nonetheless, I'm throwing it at you.
Yeah. So, you know, from BrightSign's perspective, you know, our goal is really to be the endpoint device on pretty much any kind of video experience that there is out there. So whether you're doing, you know, a POP display like a GoPro display, or you're doing an interactive display in an exhibit or a museum, all of those things are what we're going for, is to basically have the device that you can deploy and it's stable and reliable. So no matter what software you're running on it, we basically want to be the endpoint driving the experience. And I think for the overall digital signage industry, if you look at, you know, literally in the last 5 years, where we were and where we are and where we're going is, you know, 5 years ago, people talked about digital signage, but the number of deployments that with large numbers was relatively small. Now you look at it and, you know, just like I was telling you earlier that, you know, we're going to do a few hundred thousand devices, which means kind of every business day is 1,000 devices being shipped out. And it's not being shipped into distribution. It's being shipped out to be installed. Mm-hmm. Those trends are going more and more where you will see digital signage being a standard, not an exception, as the way you do marketing and information display. It's just, it's moving in that direction. And I think it's finally starting to kind of gain the critical mass where it's not like, oh my God, should we think about doing it? It's how are we going to do it? What are we going to do? And what are we going to do to create something that's exciting for the person actually viewing it versus, oh, it's just a simple display. And with the technologies like 4K and HTML5, you can now bring these experiences together that wow people. And I think you'll see it both from a pragmatic point of view, like, you know, digital menu boards, being able to show the latest regulatory information, whether it's salt content or calorie content or nutritional content, whatever the new law comes in. I think there's going to be the pragmatic side that it's like, you don't want to be printing those, to the other side, which is like, oh, I want to show off my products with a video wall that's eye-catching to bring people into my store. All of those things are going to be the things that's going to be coming, you know, into our world. And then you layer on top of that the new world of mobile. And I think mobile interactivity is going to be part of this new way of doing things, where it's not only an eye-catching display, but with everyone with their mobile devices out, you're going to see them wanting to be able to get that interactivity going with their mobile device because they've already got it out and playing with it. And then the last part, I think you're going to see more and more of, mostly because it's kind of automatic content generation, is real-time social media. We're seeing a lot of businesses really liking the real-time social media. Now, the reality is most of that is moderated, but the real-time flow through of that, of having people giving their opinions so that the content on the screen seems hyper-fresh, you're going to see that more and more with where digital signage is going.
Hmm. Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Jeff. That was terrific.
Okay. Well, hey, thanks, Dave, and good chatting with you.
All right. Take care. That's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed listening and that you learned something. If you want to stay on top of what's happening and actually matters in digital signage, join thousands of readers who visit 16.9, that's 16-9.net every day. 16.9 the blog and now the podcast are both properties of Vertical Media Consulting Group, the massive media empire I run out of a spare bedroom in my house near Toronto. Thanks to our podcast sponsor, ScreenFeed, and thank you for listening. I'm Dave Haynes.